I've been thinking a lot lately about what it means to feel helpless. As Google describes it, it's being unable to defend oneself or to act without help. And in every part of the world, in millions of relative ways, people are having bouts of helplessness, which is part of any human life. But with world events weighing on people's minds, seemingly more than ever in my lifetime anyway, I think it's important to work towards perspective of what is helplessness versus what is an emotional reaction to something that might be perceived as helplessness. For me, the topic of helplessness has shown up a lot in my personal life lately. Nothing, of course, which is completely unique to me, but I'm really conscious that I need to be careful that I receive each of these bouts of helplessness individually, for to lump them all together could lead me to danger of heading to another dark chapter of my life, as I believe it could do for others just like me. My helplessness. Well, today is an example. I called my dad at 8:13 a.m. to be precise. He answered the phone sounding a little strange. He then told me he was lying on the floor and he couldn't get up. He said there was someone knocking at the door, which was presumably his daily nurse visiting, trying to give him his insulin. I was too far away at that moment to be of any immediate help. I made some frantic calls to see who I knew who might be nearby with a key to open the door, but for a while nothing was falling together, and I felt angry, which was the fear and frustration, and I felt helpless. Nothing like what my dad, lying on his own floor, unable to get his body up, having to talk through a door to the nurse, would have felt, but it was my viewpoint of helplessness. Another example of this emotion came to me just over a month ago when one of my best friends lost her mother. She'd been battling cancer for years, and of course that meant that my friend, her family and her friends, close friends like me, perceived, which turned out to be true, that there was more of a chance that she would lose her mother sooner than the rest of us would. So there was a long, drawn-out helplessness with that for every person involved. But I had it in my head that at least that gave me the time to plan what my response would be when the time came. And that would be to jump on the first plane to Sydney to be there for my friend and to stand with her side by side at her mother's funeral. On the day she died, I'd just arrived in Paris for the start of a holiday I'd been dreaming of for a long time. When the news came of her mother passing, I couldn't believe that everything I thought I would do and could do was taken away. My grief for my friend's loss was enormous, but my wave of helplessness felt like it was suffocating me. As synchronicity would have it, when a topic is following you around, requiring a deeper understanding and clarity of what it is and what it isn't, the following week I arrived in Cairo in Egypt and I met a young Egyptian woman called Soraya Bagat. She shared with me a unique and perhaps culturally relevant story of helplessness that has shed inspiring light on what may in some circumstances feel like helplessness, but may in fact be one emotional breath away from incredible empowerment. Firstly, I'd just like to do a little bit of a cheers to the biggest margaritas that I've ever seen in my entire life. And sitting in this... Thank you. I mean, I cannot believe that I'm in Cairo and I'm at the Four Seasons and I just can't believe I'm in Cairo, full stop. And I can't believe that I've met you through Instagram. Oh, that's such a good... Oh, God, that is such a good margarita. So firstly, I want to know, because we were planning our trip to Egypt. This is like, for my friend Kylie and her husband Scott, I've got salt caught in my throat now. For us, this is like, especially for Kylie and I, the thought of coming to Egypt has always been something that we've always, always wanted to do. I think as women, and I understand potentially naivety, but it's always been one of those places where I think, oh, if I go to Egypt, it would have to be so well organized. I'd have to be with, you know, strong man. We certainly couldn't go on your own. You couldn't even necessarily go with one other woman. There's a whole lot of stuff that comes with, I think, coming to Egypt for a woman We've just got a little bit of a sports show happening in the background there. That's all right. We'll actually just try and ignore it. Didn't it something?
Exactly. It's the men trying to make their voices heard.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. They're trying to overpower our wisdom. Anyway, consequently, we decided that we were going to go, and then Kylie's husband said that she would come. He wanted to come with us, and we said, totally understandable. But then it came down to, what are we going to wear? Everything needs to be long. Everything, you know, we need to be covered up. And there's just been this long anticipation, I guess, of, like, what is the reality of how we're going to be treated as women in Egypt? And then it was really interesting. You sent me a message on Instagram. I had hashtagged, of course, the stupidest thing ever. I just got my Egyptian visa in Australia, and I've literally taken a selfie with the visa, with my passport
open. That was very exciting to see, yes.
Very exciting to see, but I'm opening my passport with all the details in there, flashing it on Instagram, going, hey, look who's coming to Egypt. You know, they're letting me in. Anyway, a friend told me I should take it down because someone could pinch my details. So I've done that now. But you popped up and said, oh, that's such great news that you're coming to Egypt. And obviously we didn't know each other. This is the first time that we've met, which is so cool. And I was like, how do I know this girl? Do I know this girl? So I don't even know how did that come across that you saw my post?
I thought you were really cool. I had seen news coverage about you years ago. You had this birthday party. And it was exactly like
my 40th birthday party?
That's how I would do my birthday party. And I was like, this is a cool woman.
Is that also because there was a royal friend of mine there? I mean, that's the only reason why I got coverage.
That's the reason why I got coverage. But what I actually really liked was the fact that there's a woman out there who celebrates the fact that, you know what, I've had a great life. Why shouldn't women have a big celebration? Why do we conform to certain norms? I'm in the same, you know, boat. And I think in 6 years I would exactly like to have the same party. I thought it was really cool.
That is so sweet. Well, that's not what I thought that you were saying. That's not how I thought you would have come to know me. In fact, I thought, oh, maybe it's just that I've hashtagged Egypt. And then once I came to know who you are in Egypt and just this incredible work and activism and movement that you really are creating as a young Egyptian woman, I just went, wow, this is amazing. And maybe, yes, you've just seen a hashtag. But that's very cool. And actually, just so you know, because you haven't turned 40 yet, one of the things, and I know you don't have a partner at the moment, and you've got plenty of time to get one, but if you don't, at that party, at my 40th, because I had never been married before, and I really, the one thing, I mean, apart from love, but I didn't grow up going, oh, you desperately need to get married. That was just never, ever my thing. What I missed about marriage, I think, is
the ceremonial aspect with
the best friends and the bridesmaids. That's exactly it. So what I decided to do was I decided to have what I called my life maids. So I literally called up six of them and I said, as you know, it's my 40th coming up and I'd like to ask you if you'd like to be my life maid. And they must know me very well because they just laughed and said, I would be really, really honoured for that.
But that's really cool. I mean, that's very, you don't see that every day.
And I wanted to honour them in front of everybody. And so I made them these big, tacky, hot pink sashes that said Life Made. And literally I brought them all up on stage and I thanked them for the roles that they'd played in my life. And it was also about honouring myself that, you know, like I've come a long way and no, I haven't got married, but this is my ceremony.
I did the same for my 30th.
Did you?
But I didn't have the life's mate idea. I think I'm going to steal it from my 40th.
Yeah, you can totally steal it. But no one would have heard of it in Egypt, I don't think, so you're safe.
Actually, for my 30th, I did it on a terrace on the building next to us, but we can't see it.
Oh, how beautiful.
It was also in the summer, and the whole idea was to bring everybody I love, because I think one of the beauties of a wedding is that there's a ceremonial aspect. Of course,
there is,
you're celebrating love, but you're also bringing all your friends. It's the one occasion where you invite your friends, they have to come.
Yeah.
And they're all together in the same room. How often do to throw a party where everybody that means
something
to you
to.
Is there?
Yeah.
For me, I decided also, I had a, you know, an engagement that you know, fell through, and I said, I will do a 30th birthday party that is going to be exactly the party that I would have done for my engagement / wedding.
Oh my God!
Big open bar.
I love it. We're like kindred spirits. So you said, you know, oh, if you know you want to meet, you know, or you need any tips or you'd like a drink in Egypt, you know, look me up. And I thought, what a beautiful girl. I just have to acknowledge, because I'm wondering whether this is going to get louder and louder, but there is a football match on and all the men around us in Cairo are watching that, and I'm pretty sure they're trying to turn it up louder so we get drowned out. But anyway, we will win this.
It's actually the two biggest clubs.
Is it the two? Oh God, of course it is. But you know what? It'd probably be worse if it's going to be like this at the Four Seasons. It's probably going to be worse somewhere else, isn't it? Anyway, that's okay. The two women in the entire bar will win this one. But then I was looking into, because I'm like, where do I know this girl from? Blah, blah, blah. And then I came across the incredible work you are doing on behalf of Egyptian women and the Tahrir. Am I saying it?
Tahrir.
Tahrir Bodyguard movement or group that you set up. And I just thought it was the most incredible thing. And so I want to ask you, so if you can do, because my history on Egypt and the revolutions and the and what's gone down in the last 7 years or so, from, is it 2011?
Yeah.
Can you just step me through the story of that and leading into this incredible thing that you did?
Sure. 2011, we had the revolution that was televised all over the world.
Yeah.
Everybody was in the square, and actually it was...
So Tahrir, say it again.
Tahrir Square actually liberation.
The liberation. So it's the biggest square in Cairo, yes. And it's basically
it's in the center of Cairo, not too far away from us.
Yeah, we actually drove through it the other day, and I pictured it, obviously after researching what you've been doing, and thought, my God, imagine that filled with people, and largely men. Would be overwhelming.
It was. I mean, you're talking about millions of people. It was very hard to get in and out. Forget it. If it was full capacity,
yeah.
It was impossible to get in. You just have to stand on the bridges leading to Tahrir. So people who participated in the revolution would stand on the bridges leading to Tahrir. And that's also where the American University in Cairo is, where I went, and the Cairo Museum. The revolution was televised all over the world. People were inspired. But one thing happened.
That so they were trying to get rid of which president was it?
It was President Mubarak.
Yep.
He'd been a president for 30 years.
Yeah, long time.
And the night that he finally resigned, there was a very tragic thing that happened, which was there was a CBS journalist. Her name was Lara Logan.
My name is Lara Logan, and I am the chief foreign affairs correspondent for CBS News.
Nearly 3 months ago, our Lara Logan was beaten and sexually assaulted by a mob in Cairo, Egypt, while covering the celebrations after Hosni Mubarak stepped down as president.
She was brutally sexually assaulted, she was stripped naked, she was taken by her bodyguards when they were able to rescue her after military intervention.
And she worked for 60 minutes, she was there reporting.
Yeah. 60 minutes. Yeah. So she was reporting, and she was in hospital for 5 days in New York, and she only spoke months later, and that just moved me so much.
And I read, I went back and read what happened to her, and she was obviously there reporting, she was there with her crew. And as the crowd swelled, she got separated from her crew. And then in a sort of a split second, a mob kind of like started attacking her and literally stripped her naked, were digitally raping her from like just, so many men she didn't even, you would go into complete shock, but she just said she could just feel hands inside her and all over her. And traumatizing for her crew as well, because they could obviously see that she was being swept away, and horrific. So how did you come to know that had happened? Was it after, I presume?
I saw it in the news. At the time, the Egyptian news, to be honest with you, didn't make much of it, because obviously they did not want to, you know...
Wasn't big news here?
It wasn't the big news here. They tried to discredit her story because... from a public relations perspective, you had this inspiring book like the Egyptian Revolution.
Yeah, right.
And they didn't want
to
tarnish.
This is bad PR, yeah.
So they had to suppress the story. But I was there in the square. I didn't see her. But I felt that there was something in the air, you know, that there were the men around us who were behaving in a certain way.
Yeah.
And they were pushing. And I remember my partner at the time, who was my fiancé, and never worked out, but anyway.
Yeah.
God bless him, he said, Soraya, we need to leave immediately. So when I went home, and in the morning when the news broke, there was something in the back of my head that I need to do something about it. And I kept, you know, it took me a year to do something about it, a year and a few months to do something about it. Because I kept thinking, you know, that this should never happen to a woman, I should take a stand. And then it happened to a few more women, but there was a media blackout. You didn't really hear about it. It happened to a British woman. And then...
And would it, presumably it would be happening to Egyptian women as well.
As well, but, you know, there's also the cultural aspect of... being embarrassed, being afraid to speak about it, because, you know, some of them, they live here and they don't want to be, their reputations to be tarnished by this, unfortunately. And I had had enough. So basically the story goes that one day, and I had always wanted to do something. I knew that I could make
it. So it was parked in you.
Absolutely. I wanted to do something about this. I was in the office. I was actually an HR director at the time of a very big Egyptian real estate company, and I was on my way to Tahrir myself and to protest. And everybody was gone in the office. I was supposed to go with men, as you said, you know, in the beginning, in the introduction, that, you know, traveling with men.
So
you would always be told, you have to go to the square with a group of men so that they can protect you. You cannot go alone.
And that would be enough protection if you were with men?
Usually,
not always, no.
If you're separate, sometimes you're playing with your phone, sometimes the mob overwhelms the man, and they see an opportunity, and they will take the girl, and the same assault that happened to Lara Logan will exactly happen to someone else.
What was the protest about that you wanted to go to?
I went to protest against, so basically after Mubarak, the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, you know, was running the country, and then we had an election. But the election was very interesting because it's basically the lesser of two evils. So it's either, you know, somebody who's old guard, who was Mubarak's chosen prime minister right before he resigned, or a candidate from the Muslim Brotherhood.
Uh-huh.
Who are not exactly known for, you know, their progressive stance on women.
No. So you weren't going to we weren't going in their favor.
I was going to protest against the Muslim Brotherhood president, who eventually won. But he was gradually taking over all powers. So he was making a constitutional declaration that, you know, was giving him more powers. So we all went to protest, and we were protesting, like, we had a protesting schedule. Every Friday, every Tuesday, every Friday, every Tuesday.
Really?
That square would be completely packed. Tuesday was a working day, but we'd take off. We'd go, like, you know, after working for 4 or 5 hours, we'd leave work at 1 or 2 and go. And Friday was a weekend for us, so we would just go, you know, all day. And that day, when the office was alone, I had a panic attack just of the idea that I'm going to go to the square alone. And I kept breathing.
Have you ever had a panic attack before?
Many. But
yeah, I have too. I have too. And I think anyone that understands panic attacks, they are horrific. And mine used to start with the little pins around, it felt like down sort of near my ovaries, the little pins, and then it would just, for me it would end up, I would eventually not be able to breathe and I'd usually black out. So what's your...
For me...
On that
it
day, anyway.
It starts with the pain, the sharp pains in my stomach, and then it starts with me not being able to breathe.
Yeah.
And just, like, you know, holding myself like this, just wanting to find a duvet and a bed and go and hide.
Yeah.
And I calmed myself down and I said, no woman should feel this way.
But you were obviously feeling incredibly driven. As much as your body or your fear was starting to rise and cripple you, you're obviously feeling like you wanted... You knew you were going on your own. You obviously felt like you really wanted to do that, whether you were physically able or not, but you really wanted to.
Yes, I wanted to very much because I felt that no woman should go through it. I thought about all the women who have been through such assaults, who are in the square and who are afraid that an assault is about to happen.
There's something has happened to that you're fearing now. Could happen to you.
So I said, you know what, well, I got to toughen up. And as I was calming myself down, I was talking to myself like some of us do, and I was saying, well, calm down, calm down, calm down. And I was telling myself, if only I had a bodyguard in Tahrir, I would go confidently. All women need to have a bodyguard in Tahrir. And then I was like, well, wait a minute. I could be that person. I am going to be the Tahrir bodyguard for women. And I was anonymous, and I swore. Of course, I had a deadline for work, and I had other things to do, but I swore that if I go on Twitter and that handle is available, Tahrir bodyguard, I swore to God that I was going to go to the bank, withdraw $1,000, buy and get this going. This was a Tuesday, and I said Friday morning.
So you had the idea in your head of the uniform. What was the uniform that was coming to you?
Because I was working for a real estate developer, I had to think of the quickest and the most practical thing. It was a construction helmet and a construction vest.
Because so it was bright, so it would stand out.
Exactly, at night, neon vests. And the helmets are to protect the heads because it got really vicious when you were trying to free a woman from a mob. They used sticks so they don't hit the volunteers on their heads.
Yeah.
And also so that you can see them from above. So I had everything, and I went to Microsoft Paint, did this logo. I chose the lion, basically the bridge that leads to... Tahrir Square is a very iconic bridge. There are all these lions. It's, if I'm not mistaken, I think they were created by a French artist. I hope I'm not mistaken, but they're iconic. I mean, these lions, everybody has a picture with these lions, they're very famous. So yeah. And I said lions symbolize bravery.
And protection.
And they're like almost overlooking Tahrir. So I said that's the best logo, bingo,
love
done.
Love it, yeah. So what space of time is this all kicking off that you're going? Because I also read that you, that also how the whole kind of concept of the uniforms came about was also because you were traveling on a train and you were going like past a lot of construction, and you're obviously thinking about this thing and it's formulating in your head, and you're like, well, how could I get something quick that stands out? And you're thinking, oh, this very boring train ride that I'm on is suddenly like this. It's like, there it is.
I used to commute to work.
Flashing before my eyes.
I used to commute to work for a long time, and I would always see them. And, you know, sometimes I think my story is a story of several points and several stars that just aligned on one day.
Yeah.
You know, and I decided that also it was very easy because I was an HR director.
You knew how to recruit.
Yep. Give me the procurement department. This is the HR director. Give me the number of the supplier. Call the supplier with very much authority. Hello, this is the HR director.
I'm on a mission. It's probably not the one that my boss knows about, but I am on a mission nonetheless.
Yeah. Absolutely. Like, I need 200 helmets and vests.
Immediately.
Excuse me. He's like, yeah, it's going to take us a few days. No, I need them. I did them a day and a half. I need them to be delivered Thursday.
And did you feel like they needed to be done really quickly because you this ongoing process that was going on, it was like, we need to get back out there. But we...
Because the next big day was Friday. So I was like, I need to do this on Friday because I know myself also. Sometimes I think the one thing I've learned from this, if you have an idea, just follow it and the whole world will follow it as well. But you got to really follow it. And I said, that's it. I cannot procrastinate on this. This has to happen now. Done. Something's been set in motion.
Woman on a mission.
Exactly. And the funny
anecdote... A big mission.
But I have to tell you something. So I was alone. And then I said, okay, so now... It was an order. I called the procurement department. I got the contact. I ordered the uniforms. I created
the logo. You paid for them yourself?
Yeah, I went to the bank, withdrew $1,000, got back up, and then, you know, had the money to pay the suppliers. The bank was conveniently located right under my office.
Wow.
So I had everything, but I did not have the men. And I said, okay, procrastinating until I figure out how to get 200 men by Friday, I said I have to launch this on social media. So I go on social media, on Twitter. It's available. And then I didn't write, of course, in the beginning. I was like, I'm on a mission to end the sexual violence in Tahrir Square. Please support me. And they said, no. Nobody wants to support a woman by herself. So I wrote, we are a group.
Oh, so you worded it and said, oh, no, hang on. I've got to sound like I've got a few people with me here. This is a movement already. It's not just me behind my typewriter.
I'm not trying to start it. I'm not trying desperately to start it. It's already started.
This has started. The
thing is that as I started tweeting, in the beginning I started tweeting safety tips. Like, you know, please avoid this area. We advise you to maybe, you know, try to deflect from attention. We know it's not a woman's fault.
Yeah.
this happens, etc. If you see anything, please report. We're working on it. And
so you're also, like, by the language you're using, you're really, as you said, you're trying to make it sound like there are more than one person behind this. You're obviously not trying to frighten people. You're encouraging that it's okay. We know that this goes on, and there is help that is going to be there. Here's some tips. Like, you know, this is, and also by the tips and the safety, it further kind of like establishes the idea that, you know, this is an organized group. We are happening.
We're happening. Please contact us if you see anything. Let us know. Please, if you want to volunteer, blah blah, send us your contact. And the funniest thing happened. I just saw the followers number balloon.
Really?
By the end of the first day, we were 1,000.
Wow. And were you checking who was following? Like, were you nervous that there would be, you know, kind of like the wrong men following you, going, who's this little piece of work?
No, I was so overwhelmed, but I was laughing secretly because I saw some of my friends following, and I was like, in a million years, they will not guess it's me.
Well, they wouldn't have even known it was you. It's not like you're saying, hey, can everyone just follow me? I'm trying to start a movement here.
That was my name. So I was laughing because I was thinking about the moment when I reveal myself down the line.
Oh, wow.
But it was amazing. And then the funniest thing happened. So we were like, after like an hour, we were approaching 1,000, and it just by the end of the first day, we were 1,000. And 5 p.m. This all started at 12. 5 p.m. I get an email from CNN. Hello, we were wondering where you are exactly in the square because we need to shoot you. And I was like, okay, now there's no turning back. I really got to have these 200 men in helmets and vests.
Because I've got a really good PR opportunity
exactly.
here.
And it's done. I mean, they're asking me, when can we film?
Yeah.
And I said, well, we're focusing right now on the work, so we would like to just, you know.
If you could just hold off, we'd love to do that piece with you. Just in a couple of weeks, and just when my calculator hits 200.
Absolutely.
Oh, my
absolutely.
God.
And,
so they had, they'd obviously heard about your tweets.
They've seen the tweets. Yeah.
And are you hashtagging certain things to
I
get attention?
Tahrir bodyguard, Tahrir Egypt. And,
so people
and
would have been, so would people have been following those hashtags,
yes.
Especially because around the protests were regular and people were trying to keep updated as to.
Absolutely. I mean, the media, including foreign media, they were descending every, you know, Tuesday, every Friday on this.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
We're talking about the largest international media outlets. So, fast forward 3 days, I did manage to get the 200 men.
Through Twitter? Like, simply through
no.
Twitter? No.
Through powers of persuasion. I went to a friend of mine who was high-ranking in a political party, and I invited him to a drink, and I told him, I need a favor. I have something you have, and you have something I have.
Wow. And how did you... And then what did you say?
Well, his party was in charge of securing the square, and he had so many volunteers, but he had no uniforms for them.
Right.
But I had 200 uniforms. And I told him, well, it's a disgrace if women are being sexually assaulted in the square that you're in charge of protecting. So... We need
you
to
have the people.
Together.
I have the little uniforms. Oh, wow. And he immediately agreed? Was he concerned about...
No, he trusted me. He knew me well enough. We did it.
Wow.
And it just... And then that's what... And I told him when we were, like, delivering the 200 uniforms. And I went.
So they were delivered to his...
Where straight to Square.
Yeah. To his people. Yep.
To his people. Straight. I told the supplier, I mean, I'm sorry, I have a very bit of an unusual delivery address. And then we did that. And then I said, give me 20. I want to start this organically. And then I started this organically. There were great people that I met that then brought their friends. And then it ballooned to 350. But when the members of the media descended on Tahrir Square that Friday,
yeah.
They saw 200 men in the Tahrir bodyguard, in the vests and helmets. They saw this tower that they had built just to be able to see what's going on in the square.
Wow.
And then the story broke. I first was anonymous. I had a pseudonym. My name was Salman Baradei. And then, because I wanted really to focus on the cause and not focus on me. And
yeah.
Then it was covered by every single media.
And then it becomes even more fabulous. It's like this gorgeous young, incredibly passionate.
Yeah.
Smart woman is behind this, and she's actually done it on.
That. Exactly.
Yeah,
they wanted
oh, it's
that,
a so wonderful
like,
story.
No, actually, no, we want the face, we want that part.
Yeah,
of the
yeah,
actually.
This makes it so much more powerful
so
than something that might be
yeah.
seen as not a token, but I guess everyone's quite suspicious of. You know, especially international media, they'd probably be suspicious too of, oh, well, how much, you know, who is running this and is this a token thing and are they really protecting these women? And
No, they love this that it was started by a woman who was scared. They love the panic attack. They wrote about that. And then
love the panic attack. Love that.
I'm like, thank you for loving my panic attack.
Yeah, it's great.
Should get them more often.
Yeah.
And then I think my name came out, and then I got all these invitations to start giving speeches, to start talking about it, to, you know, and I did something that I really like. I mean, I like meeting people and talking about my experience, and if there's anything that I could say that would maybe inspire or motivate them, then that's something for me that's a great honor. And I've been very thankful, because this experience has taken me to Morocco to speak to university students, to France to speak to university students who are interested in this, and the welcome that I've received has been overwhelming, and also Freedom Forum to give a keynote
about, you know, females and women
and the power
sexual harassment and
civilian intervention, the power of bringing together civilians to overcome a large adversity. I mean, this was not easy because it's not structured. Nobody's seen this around the world. I mean, this whole mob sexual assault thing, it was the first time we'd hear of something of that scale in Egypt.
And also it being talked about publicly out of Egypt too, rather than someone going in and reporting and saying, this seems to be happening, and, you know, I'm getting anonymous conversations here, you know, confirming that this happens. I mean, obviously, and it goes back again to thinking this is a very big country, 93 million or so, which is an enormous amount of people, especially when you come from Australia and, what are we, 24 million or something. And, you know, I mean, this is, I mean, what is the ratio of religion, like, what is the, it's mostly Muslim, yeah.
It's mostly Muslim. The official statistic is that Copts are Christians who are mostly Coptic in Egypt. We obviously have also, you know, Catholic, Orthodox, we also have Protestant. We have many denominations, but the main denomination would be the Coptic, it's the Egyptian church. Would be around 12%.
Yeah.
That's the official statistic. Maybe it's a little higher, I'm not sure. But the official statistic is...
But were you worried about yourself becoming kind of the face of something like this? Because this really goes against what a large part of the male population think, which is women have their place and we, you know, we're in charge.
I know what you mean.
Because, you know, it goes back to Kylie and I just being these two little Australians being nervous about being in a country where, you know, men... are a lot, you know, I mean, it is a different
bullet.
Yeah, more dominant, and, you know, there's a huge intimidation, and the religion is not necessarily in favor of women. You know, I'm speaking incredibly ignorantly, but, you know, to make a name for yourself as a woman who lives in this country, to be standing up and kind of, you know, in a very large way, sort of holding men, those certain men, to account. I it's very brave.
I'll tell you something. I'll tell you two things, actually. I was not thinking about anything. This was one moment in my life where I am, when people tell me, like, you know, you did well, I'm like, you have no idea. That's the best thing that has happened to me. I am lucky that this happened to me, because this was one time where I was not thinking. I didn't think about the consequences to my personal safety. I didn't think, my parents were not exactly thrilled in the beginning.
No, they would have been frightened for you.
When people called them after I made my media appearances, they were like,
this is like amazing. Yeah.
And I always threatened them that I'm going to tell everybody that they weren't in the beginning. And now it's been a year, so I can say that.
Yeah.
But I wasn't thinking about anything except the women. This was the one time in my life where nothing mattered.
Yeah.
I do realize that in hindsight, you know, I could have been arrested. I could have been.
And if you'd stopped to think about it and hadn't been just sort of, hadn't gone with the inner sort of passion and drive to pull that off, and especially in a short space of time, if you'd had any more time, or I guess been slightly weakened in any way, to have that moment to think, oh, hang on, is this going to put me in danger? You know, if people see my face, am I going to be recognised in the street? And then this happens to me, not even in this square, but it could happen, you know.
I didn't, honestly, the honest answer is, I wasn't thinking. It was the one time in my life where, I can honestly say that
didn't overthink
I just went with the flow. The flow took me. I followed my idea, and I never thought about the dangers to me. I just thought about all the women that we were saving, and I mean, we've saved like a very big number. And for me, that was the greatest thing. I wasn't always with the boys.
Is this football match kicking off?
Yeah. It is. Okay. People have been waiting for this one for a long time.
Oh, have they? Okay. we're on. Yeah, we hate this, but we're on a time constraint because the more this gets towards the end of this this football match, who is actually playing?
For international listeners, it's the equivalent of Barcelona and Madrid.
Oh my God! Okay, we're really under time constraints because this whole place could erupt soon.
It will. But just as a second point that I wanted to say is that I wanted to talk about the 200 men. I mean, the men who put themselves
my God.
In harm's way.
What, Tia? Tell me about them on that day.
Because, you know, this has gotten its media coverage. People have seen what some men have done, but the majority of men have been the men who joined groups like mine. Who, you know, I've had one of the key directors in the movement, because it actually grew, and then we had directors and we had teams and we structured it. And we,
wow.
And he actually got hurt before in one of the intervention cases because he insisted on getting the girl out. And he lost the mobile phone. I mean, they have...
This is one of the bodyguards?
Yes, they have sacrificed a lot. They were never paid. They volunteered. There were people, like, they were very poor street vendors.
Yeah.
Who took off their clothes to cover a woman.
Wow.
I mean, to me, this is the real Egypt. These are the Egyptian men that make me proud.
Yes, that's right.
To see that spirit of these men risked so much. I feel that, you know, they're the ones who actually put themselves in harm's way, because as a woman, I would always be in the back.
Yeah.
If I was in the square, because they obviously did not want to have another woman that they have to get out, you know?
Yeah.
They wanted to focus, and me being around was not exactly always conducive to that.
Yeah.
Shall we say? I mean, I had another role to play, which was the social media, which was gathering, you know, ambulances or setting up what would happen after.
That's right. If something does happen, how do we then?
Hand over the women and girls, we would hand them over to the ambulances that were waiting outside the square, so that they could be taken either, you know, home or to a medical facility.
And so on that night, did women get assaulted? Like, were there...
The first night?
Yeah, the first night.
We saved a lot of women. One of the worst nights that we've had was January 25th, 2013, which was the second anniversary of the revolution. There were between 18 to 20 girls and women. Some are young as 14, some were as old as 70, you know, it doesn't really discriminate.
Yeah.
It's a matter of opportunity.
Yeah, yeah.
It feels like such a lifetime ago.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
But I have to tell you, it was really the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. And if there's one thing that I've learned from it is, again, as I've said, you know, if you have an idea, just follow it with all your heart and soul, no matter how crazy or silly it is. Because, I mean, let's just think about that moment when I got the idea. How presumptuous was I as a woman alone who's scared, having a panic attack, to think that I would create a movement that would not only be successful locally, but that would actually also garner
so much attention,
international media attention, and actually force the Egyptian, you know, media to start talking about it, and for there to be measures. And the law has changed now. We have a law that discusses sexual harassment, or refers to sexual harassment.
It's opened up the conversations.
It has pushed the conversation forward, because you couldn't hide it anymore.
And do you do a lot of those interviews? Like, is your profile elevated a lot here? I mean, I asked our tour guide today. I showed him a photo of I told him your name, and he said, "Oh, I'm not really sure." And then I showed him a photo, and he said, "Oh, I've seen this girl."
Yeah, because I was on one of the biggest TV shows in our region, which has about a viewership of 30 million viewers on TV and about maybe 10 million on the internet.
Wow.
And I was the main guest, and I spoke about this issue. We spoke out about this issue, and we need to also tackle the side issues, because the issue is not just about women being assaulted in the square.
Yeah.
It's also the reactions, because there would be some men, I mean, the most common three questions that I was always asked was, what was she wearing? Because, you know, sometimes there's this idea ingrained in people's minds that
she did something.
Did she wear something provocative for this to happen? No matter how liberal these people are that ask that question, it is something that's been ingrained in our country. The second question was, like, who was she with? Because they assumed, of course, you know, what kind of a man would let this happen to? She must have been with a man, whether a brother, a father, a boyfriend, a friend, a fiancé, a colleague. how did this happen? And number three, which was the silliest of them all, if she knows that this happens there, why did she go? Why did she risk herself? So, I mean, I started speaking out also against the reaction and about gender equality. And I think that what happened afterwards when the protests in Tahrir ceased and Tahrir bodyguard became obsolete, I started working on other issues. It's opened my mind to issues of female genital mutilation, gender equality, women's empowerment. So I'm very lucky to.
So it's really it's unlocked a much bigger purpose.
Absolutely, I wasn't
for you.
Thinking, I wasn't thinking that I would be ever referred to as a women's issues advocate, as an advocate for girls. I never thought that this would be me.
And how old are you?
I'm 34.
So you're so young to have done that.
I was 29 at the time.
Wow, that's incredible. And so, I mean, you know, can't go into the whole, you know, issue of, I guess, religion or behavior, but what is it, do you believe? Because, you know, and we've only been here a couple of days, and we have to say, and obviously we haven't gone to a protest, and we wouldn't do, you know, regardless. You know, we stand out a little bit. We clearly look like we don't belong. But we have had a much nicer response from everybody that we've met in Egypt so far, and including a lot of really lovely men. And what is it about that sort of, when they're in that big group, that frenzied drive to sexually assault women? Have you got any kind of insights on, like, why? Why are they...
That is the million-dollar question. I can tell you a few things. I mean, we have had an issue of sexual harassment. And I'm from a generation of women who've been subjected to sexual harassment. I always say the analogy of that. What happened in Tahrir Square is basically you had this little dog that you know is very aggressive and bites. But you tolerated it because the sexual harassment has also evolved. In the beginning, it would just be a funny comment that could be taken in a humorous way. Flirty way, and then, you know, it would escalate to touching. But what happened is that day the dog broke loose and, you know, bit your neighbor's child. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
It was a mutation, it was a viciousness that we had not seen.
It burst.
There were previously a few cases of mob sexual harassment. Did not escalate to this level. It was during a time when it was the feast and there were a lot of people around the cinema. There was another case in front of the journalist syndicate when some women were protesting and it was a large protest. But this was a viciousness that shook everyone.
Yeah.
Even those working in the field of sexual harassment for a long time. A lot of people use reasons such as, you know, this is a conservative culture, people only engage in sexual relations when they're married. Some people also, you know, put it down to...
So a bit of starvation of sexual, you know, even expression.
Exactly. And some put it
that it's going to burst.
Violence, just pure an expression of...
How can I be the most violent to that person? Which for women is sexual,
That some men are facing economic hardships, that they're unemployed, that they have this anger that they want to take out on someone.
To
and
express.
Who can they take it out on? I mean, they can take it out on women.
Yeah.
In all cases, this has led me to work on other issues, like, you know, that are all related to the idea of gender equality.
Yeah.
That, you know, women and men are equal, that they're not inferior, that you cannot just, you know, get away with touching them or harassing them.
Yeah.
And there was also this I think there was this idea that some have genuinely started believing that, oh yes, maybe these women are asking for it, they're not covered.
I'm sure there must be a lot of that. I mean, especially if you know, I mean, they're obviously, and it's definitely not to presume that women don't want to you know, cover themselves and live by I don't even know that you'd call it extreme. It's not extreme. It's the Muslim way with the.
It's the burqa, I mean.
The burqa, yeah. So it's the.
We call it in Egypt. We call it the niqab.
Yeah. Okay. The niqab. So, yeah. I mean, there is. I mean, you know, a lot of women have that. That is the way they want to live their life. But there must be a lot of men that believe that we all should.
Yeah, but there's also, I mean, after so this has also been a very liberal country. If you look at the Egyptian movies of the early 20th century, you know, from 1920 to 1980, you see, you know, we had this cinema industry that was watched all over the Middle East. Especially, I mean, my favorite, old Arabic movies are, you know, the movies from the 1940s to the 1960s. That was the golden era of Egyptian cinema. You did not see veiled women.
Yeah.
You did not see, they weren't any veiled women. My grandmother tells stories about, you know, that there were not veiled women. This whole veil phenomenon.
It's a real misconception. I think from where we live, exactly. There's a lot of ignorance.
Part of our culture, you know, because of the political and economic developments in our country, you know, in the late 70s, there were many workers who were in Saudi Arabia. They have come back to Egypt with that Wahhabism and the veil. But it's not. I mean, my grandmother will tell you that, you know, there weren't any veiled women. My mother will tell you at Cairo University that she saw the emergence of the veil. That was a wave, as I said, of Wahhabism from Saudi Arabia, from workers who've been there, who've been influenced by it. And then now it has taken over.
Yeah, I see. That's not the original Egypt. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about Egypt, and you know, I think also even just going back to Kylie and I with our very sort of, you know, small time dilemma about what we should, you know, wear. You know, Kylie's, and you'll meet her in a second. She's already texted me to say that she's looking for me, but. What I was going to say is, you know, she's a very naturally sexy girl. She finds it really hard not to be sexy. She looks sexy. She does dress sexy, but that is just who she is. And so the two of us, you know, we packed all of these clothes that we felt that is what we should wear in Egypt. And it was literally the first night that we were here and we're at the hotel, and all of these beautifully dressed women like yourself are all swanning through the hotel, and we're like, why have we got a whole week's worth of this terrible, like, you know, really awful clothes? She's been walking around in these, like, pale, you know, long-sleeve linen shirts. It's just so not her. And these long kind of, like, baggy, elastic waist, you know, pants. And I've got, you know, and we're just feeling so ordinary, and we just keep realizing that we've made broad assumptions on what we've made broad assumptions against Egyptian women, to be quite honest. I mean, you know, we can say, oh no, it's against the men, but it's actually underestimating the reality of a lot of Egyptian women and their right to fashion and being very independent
and
in this country.
They're the ones.
Oh God. Oh, do you hear it? Yeah.
These are the women who have made such strides that, you know, enabled the passing of the law on sexual harassment, which even includes sexual harassment by phone. These are the women who are pushing forward every day. These are the women who are actually not shutting up. This year has actually been designated the year of the Egyptian woman.
Is that right? The year of the Egyptian women.
The year of the Egyptian women.
We have
a minister of investment who is absolutely fantastic and inspirational.
What's his or her name?
Her name is Sahar Nas.
I'm glad to say here. You say her name is?
Yes. Her name is Dr. Sahar Nas. She's actually holding two ministries at the same time, international cooperation and investment. She's been very inspiring.
And there is support for women.
There is support for women. I mean, she is a very brilliant minister. The president supports her a lot, obviously, and values her contribution. We have, for the first time, I mean, if we talk about numbers, this parliament, this round of parliament, has the highest representation of women for a very, very long time. I mean, under the Muslim Brotherhood, it was like 2%. Now we're talking about a parliament of 15%.
Yeah.
So it is moving.
So things are moving forward in Egypt as they are in hopefully a lot of countries. Yeah, for women's place in parliament and all jobs.
But it's also because of women. I mean, I think that there was a barrier, fear that was broken during the revolution, because Mubarak was toppled not just because of men. It was women who went to the square and, you know, stood shoulder next to the man, and the man said that he goes away.
And I just have to say that I think that Egyptian women like yourself, but any Egyptian woman, that goes into that square and protests and look, all kind of ignorance from my end out of this, but I get nervous around large packs of men. I just do. I just feel that kind of that primitive, even if it's like going into a pub in Sydney or something and it's full of NRL players, I get very nervous about that. I can tell you now, and I like to think that I'm brave in many aspects, even knowing what you're doing, and I don't mean this to sort of completely undo everything that you're saying, because you want to empower women to be able to go to these protests and know that there's support there, but knowing that there's just, you know, a million or so people in a square, I find that very, very scary in general. And that's, I just think the women that, like you, that go there and stand up for your rights in a much more tumultuous, political and religious environment than dear old Australia. I mean, let's be honest, there's no fear of anything just apart from just, you know, if there's a protest, there's really nothing, not a lot to fear there most of the time. But I just think it's incredibly, incredibly... It's obviously an ongoing... battle and sort of charge with a lot of Egyptian women to be fighting against something bigger than women in other countries, and there's women's issues in every country and they're relative to whatever that country is, but I really, really admire what you and other Egyptian women and let's not forget these beautiful Egyptian men.
Yes.
That are there supporting you and knowing that that's, you know, not going to be easy for them, and they'll, you know, they might get, you know, turned on themselves. I just think it's incredible and it's incredibly inspiring, and I do really, really think that Egypt is very, a very interesting place, and I think that I think it's a little sad that tourism is down quite a lot at the moment because of people's fears in general around the world. You know, in this trip I've gone to Paris, Egypt, and I'm going to London. You know, it's more likely that something could potentially happen in Paris or London by far, like, than there is in Egypt. But I think because there's an old attitude that, oh, Egypt, there's all the bombs and, you know, things like that. I just think people should put things into perspective. You know, there's a lot of people here.
I'm really glad to hear that after.
Oh, we're really finding that this trip already, and we've only been here a handful of days. And you know, we've sat in our little minivan on the way back to the hotel tonight. So we really need to go back and tell people that they're not being fair to Egypt by doing this. You know, we've had text messages from family members and various people saying, you know, I mean, Kylie had someone begging her, a friend, begging her not to come to this country because of the assumptions that something awful would happen to us.
But wait until you see my favourite part of my country. I live in Cairo, but, I mean, the south, to me, the temples, like the big temples, like the real temples that you see recreated in Hollywood movies, I couldn't be prouder to be, part of this country.
And look, you know what, we've got this incredible tour and we went to the Great Pyramids of Giza today and we saw the Sphinx and all of those things are incredible, but I know a whole lot of people are not going, saying to themselves, oh, it's not a good time to go and see those wonderful things, or it's not a good time to, like, tick off my bucket list for Egypt at the moment. And I just think that's not right, and that's having a very black and white view of actually what Egypt and the individual people are about.
I was very happy when I saw your post. I remember I was like so excited. Yes, people like you to come.
We do to come and to talk about it
and to see it, to have the courage to see it for themselves.
Do you know, we also, this is another really ignorant thing that we said. We literally, all the way to the airport and then the weeks leading up, we keep having this joke with my friend's husband saying, are we going to be allowed to be ourselves in Egypt? Because we laugh a lot and we're just silly and we bring attention to ourselves. We're not trying to, but we have such a laugh together. And, you know, today we were walking around laughing and, you know, and I'm at the petrol station. I'm inside the petrol station. I'm laughing with the tour guide. And I turned around to him and I said, you know that we were scared that we weren't going to be allowed to laugh here? We didn't think that we were going to be allowed to be ourselves here.
Wacky humor, and we are known actually for making fun of absolutely everything.
But this is us too. This is our sense of humor, and we're thinking that you guys, oh no, we can't do that. We're going to offend them. They're going to be pissed off. We're going to get harassed. We're going to get mob assaulted.
You see the sense of humor of the wonderful Australian ambassador to Egypt. Fantastic sense of humor.
Yeah, tell me his name again.
Neil Hawkins.
Neil Hawkins.
Quite a wonderful man representing Australia very finely. He actually hosted an Australian women's activist and invited some of myself and, you know, women working on the field to meet her. Speaks fluent Arabic, which is, you know, very inspiring, and has
very
a fantastic sense of humor. So I've gotten a bit of the Aussie humor from him.
Oh, good. Well, you know that we don't take ourselves very seriously.
Yes, I love that.
And you know what? And what I'm loving is that I'm finding out that a whole lot of people in Egypt have actually the same sense of humor, and also don't take themselves as seriously as we thought everyone was going to. Yeah, and that is our ignorance. But I just think what you've done and what you're continuing to do is so wonderful. You know, you've obviously just now on purpose, which is such an incredible thing for anyone to find themselves, whatever it is in the world that they want to do. Just incredible. And I just can't wait to keep watching what you're up to.
And so nice meeting you.
Oh, so nice meeting you too. Can you just tell us the Twitter handle for Tahrir Bodyguard?
It's Tahrir Bodyguard, but you can follow me now because
yes. Can you give us all of those things? Because
So it's at Soraya Bahget.
Yes.
Both Instagram and Twitter.
Yes, and it's Soraya Bahget.
Bravo, Amber.
Finally got there. I'm still very new.
No, but you're doing great. You're doing great.
Well, good luck.
Shukran, which is thank you in Arabic.
Yes, I learned that today too, because I suddenly realised I want to actually converse with a few more people rather than put my head down and stop laughing. Thank you so much.
Shukran.
I got it. Next week on The Wise Guys, we're heading to Paris to meet Alana Starr, one of the most celebrated transgender performers in the world. Her talent for entertaining has taken her to Gianni Versace's infamous parties in the years before his death, to Madonna's birthday party, and now she's reigning supreme over one of Paris's favourite cabaret theatres.